Welcome to Brota GP. This is a new segment we got going. This is Ask Rob Tech Questions. Kevin posted on Facebook and Instagram asking you to submit questions for me that are specifically tech related. So a lot of people have been asking for more videos about tech things. You want to talk about electronics, you want to talk about tires. So we're giving you that. I'm running solo this time because those other guys don't know shit about tech. But all right, I went a little overboard. I've got something like 9 to 12 questions or something to answer. So let's get through this. All right, here we go. Question number one. SpongeBob on Instagram wants to know if I can clarify the technical changes from Moto 2 to Moto 3 to Moto GP. So, all right, there are obviously a lot, but we're going to try and make this as fast as possible. The main differences between all of the classes is the electronics and the motor rules. Like, obviously, the Moto 3 bikes are tiny, the Moto 2 bikes are a little bit bigger, the GP bikes are heavier still and a lot more powerful. Those are obvious, so I'm not really going to cover them. But, all right, technical stuff. Moto 3, they're running a Delorto spec ECU with a data logger built in. There's no fly-by-wire. All the engines have a rev limit. It's mostly KTM and Honda engines throughout the class. Mahindra used to be in there, but they left. And the main thing about this class is that there are cost caps on everything to prevent the manufacturers, Honda and KTM, from charging a shit ton to the teams from the cost spiraling out of control. So the engine costs are capped at 60,000 euros a year. That's for the engine allocation. Engines are actually randomly distributed by Dorna. So all the engines are given to Dorna. Dorna mixes them all up and sends them out to teams. That way, a manufacturer can't give a better engine to their factory team and worse engines to someone else. The same thing is, they're actually also homologated chassis with capped costs. And each manufacturer homologates a chassis at the beginning of the year. There's a capped cost, preventing costs from spiraling out of control. And then each manufacturer only gets one update per part every single year. So like they can make one new chassis through the middle of the year, one new swing arm, one new triple clamp, stuff like that. This keeps all of the teams having similar equipment and there being a lot of parity in the entire class. All right, that's pretty much it for Moto 3. There's not much else. Keeping this moving along, Moto 2. Moto 2 runs CBR 600 engines. They're a mild super sport build built by a third party. So they probably have HRC cams, HRC valve springs, a good cam timing, maybe some porting and polishing, but I seriously doubt it because there'd be a lot of variables for each engine build. And obviously the third party engine manufacturer wants to keep them all exactly the same. I once read that they have something like less than 1 to 2 horsepower difference between all of the motors. They run an HRC ECU, so there's really nothing fancy there. There's obviously no fly-by-wire on the CBR 600RR, so that's why we see a lot of like backing it in into the corners. The slipper clutch is actually spec 2, which in causes that as well. They run a 2D data logger. There are really no chassis restrictions like there are in Moto 3, so like Kallax can put out a new chassis as often as they want, but Kallax generally has one factory team. Speed Up has a chassis manufacturer is much smaller, so they really don't have that many people running the bike. The only real chassis restrictions are they can't run a production bike. Like they couldn't run a CBR 600 chassis and they couldn't run CBR 600 bodywork. That's about it. All right, moving on to MotoGP. There's a spec ECU in that class made by Magneti Marelli. They make the software as well. The factories can ask for software updates, but it's up to Magneti Marelli. They run full fly-by-wire. Every single, they're all of all the parameters in the ECU, they're turn based. So every single turn can have like different engine braking, different tractor control, different wheelie control. But there is actually no GPS in the spec electronics. So the electronics know where the bike is on track based on the timing gaps or the timing segments. So they cross the start finish line and then the ECU knows that the next corner is turn number one. Then they go through like, you know, two or three corners, then they go into sector number two. And then they know the first turn in sector number two is turn five, say. So the bikes are actually really smart and they know where they are on track at all time. They have engine braking control. They have active traction control. They have wheelie control. They have launch control. They have auto blip on downshift. In GP, there are engine allocation limits, except for obviously the factories get a set number of engines. The Factories with concessions get a few more engines. A factory can actually make three different engine specifications each year because engine development is frozen throughout the entire season. But like for Ducati example, they have the GP18, the GP17, and the GP16. Each of those engines can be a different specification that's totally allowed. It's a little weird. I really wish they didn't do that, but it kind of has to be that way. I already said seamless gearboxes. They have pneumatic valves. There are absolutely no chassis restrictions except for weight, overall weight. GP gets to run carbon brakes. And obviously Michelin is the tire supplier for GP, whereas Dunlop runs the other two classes. Actually, one thing I forgot to mention, GP is the only class on the grid that has, or in the paddock, that has a weight limit that is only based on the bike. Moto2 and Moto3, it's combined rider and motorcycle weight limits. What else is there to say? Oh, in 2019, Moto2 is actually changing their regulations quite a bit. They're going to a brand new Triumph 675 triple engine, and Magneti Pirelli will be making a spec ECU for that class. It's going to get fly-by-wire, which obviously is a part of the engine, and then it's actually going to have significantly more rider aids than Moto2 has right now. So this is planned partly to make it easier for Moto2 riders to move into MotoGP, because programming those electronics are a really big thing for riders, and actually reacting to them. Like we just saw that Hafi Siren came into the class. He's had no experience with advanced electronics before moving into the GP class. So it's really up to the team to teach him. With 2019 Moto2, that might be a little bit easier. All right. I think that's pretty much the major technical differences between Moto2, Moto3, and MotoGP. There are more stuff. I'm sure I forgot it all, but we really don't have time. So moving on to question number two. All right, this is kind of a two-parter, but it's mostly the same topic. So James Moran on I think that's on Instagram, noticed that Marquez uses a vented rear brake rotor, and he's asking how much rear brake the riders actually use. Neil Brown on Facebook has a very similar question. He never uses the rear brake anywhere but for wheelie control over crests and acceleration out of hairpins, but when he watches MotoGP onboards, he sees that the riders use a ton of rear brake. Here's the thing about the rear brake. It's a really, really difficult skill to master. Personally, I use the rear brake two or three times a season. It doesn't happen that often, and I'm a slower racer because of it. The rear brake is used no matter what by these pro riders, no matter the electronics, right? The spec ECU brought down the wheelie control and the traction control, and that probably caused the MotoGP racers to use a little bit more rear brake, but they were already using it. Everyone except for Jorge Lorenzo, who is kind of weird. But the main thing that most of the MotoGP racers use the rear brake for is corner entry. The rear brake is really good at slowing the bike. Like, as much as you see them have the rear tire on the ground, the second they set it down, they're on the rear brake. After that, after setting the rear tire down, the rear brake is really good at tightening the line of the bike. Anytime you are decelerating the motorcycle while holding a constant lean angle, your turning radius is decreasing. That means if you're on the rear brake, while you've got your knee on the ground, your turn is getting tighter. It's a great skill. It's very difficult to master. It will make you faster around the racetrack, but like I said, pain in the ass. As far as rear brake usage, I've heard stories about some racers replacing their rear brake pads like for every single race, maybe more than once a weekend. They use that rear brake a lot. Obviously, Marquez has a vented rear brake rotor, which is something that looks more like what's on a car. It's two pieces and there are vents down the middle. HRC has been making that brake rotor for a while. They get a lot of use out of that. And the rear brake is essential for going as fast as a GP racer. All right, moving on. Question number three. Wesley Harrell wants to know, how far is the gap between World Superbike and MotoGP technologically? And then he also wants to know about Honda, how they can dominate in MotoGP, but they struggle in World Superbike. So here's the thing. The gap is really small in certain parts of motorcycle technology. So it's very likely that Kawasaki in World Superbike has comparable electronics to MotoGP. Now that MotoGP is running spec ECU, Kawasaki might have better electronics. They've got a nice IMU, which is a gyroscope accelerometer. It helps the bike know where it is on track, how far it's leaning over, what acceleration it's doing. They have turn-by-turn adjustments. They have wheelie control, launch control, traction control, auto blip on downshift, engine braking control. They have literally everything the GP has on the Kawasaki. and it might be better than the spec electronics. Where things get quite a bit different is the other technical regulations. So GP bikes are lighter. They make probably 15 to 20% more horsepower, partly because World Superbike has really stringent regulations on what you can change about the motor. They pretty much, they can't change anything in the bottom end. They can add material like epoxy to the cylinder head to change the shape of the ports. They can polish the combustion chamber. They can, you know, do a valve job, they can change the camshafts, but they can't, you know, they can't put in bigger valves. They can't change the pistons. They can change the rods, but they have to weigh the same. They can't change the crankshaft, right? All of these things, MotoGP makes amazing ones right out of the box, whereas Kawasaki has to use what's in the stock motor. Obviously, MotoGP, they have seamless gearboxes, carbon brakes, pneumatic valves, gear-driven cams. All of those changes really add up to MotoGP being faster at pretty much every single track, especially the ones that are very horsepower driven or just have the crazy drives. The second part of that question, why does Honda suck in World Superbike? Well, that's not actually Honda. That's the Tenkate racing team with a little bit of Honda support. They've kind of, the Tenkate owner has since kind of moved out of the way and is no longer leading that team. And I think that's a new change for this year. Last year, they were also called Honda Racing, but I'm not sure if he had gotten out of the way. But it's not HRC making those bikes. The only place in the world where HRC actually supports production racing is this year, starting this year, in the in the World Endurance Championship. And they're kind of doing that because World Endurance actually gets more viewership than World Superbike. It's kind of sad. Obviously, HRC loves racing at Suzuka. They love racing in Japan. They support their Japanese racers a lot, but they don't support World Superbike. So really, World Superbike Honda is mostly just Honda Europe providing money to a team. There's not much technical support there. All right, question number four. Another two-parter. Casey Montgomery wants to know, at what point will all of these electronics be too much? Josh W55 actually replied a little bit, and he brought up the fact that the amount of electronics hasn't increased since the Spec ECU. So some interesting points here. I really don't think the electronics are ever going to be too much. Rider aids are really essential to making both a really powerful motorcycle safe. And honestly, I think that MotoGP is actually more difficult to race, or at least to win, because of all the rider aids. Sure, there are all those stories that came out about John Hopkins saying that he could just, once he got to the apex, he could go wide open throttle and let the computer sort it out. But how many races did he win? I'm pretty sure he didn't win a single race. So the guys that are winning are able to both give feedback to their technicians to have to program the software the best way possible, but they also make sure that they're one step ahead of the software, right? Mark Marquez never just lets the computer sort it out. He always opens the throttle a little bit more and modulates it perfectly so that he gets the best possible drive. And of course, all of that doesn't help you really on corner entry. We've not been able to program corner entry, right? There is no electronic braking, or there's no rider aid for braking. We have rider aids for how much engine braking you get, but that's not the front brake. So, and as the electronics get more efficient for engine braking, it means that Mark Marquez can brake even later and even harder. So I think electronics are making it more difficult. If at any point the rider aids become a lot, I think that may happen when we get electric bikes racing, but that is many, many years down the road. As far as electronic capability increasing annually, that probably does happen. I think I said this in the first question. The factories can request Magneti Marelli to put something in to the spec software. So there is a possibility that things do get better annually. On top of that, the IMU, the little electronic sensor that kind of figures out where the bike is on track and how far it's leaning and how much it's accelerating, that is not a spec sensor. And Magneti Marelli doesn't program that. They don't even make it. So all the factories get to make their own. And as such, that little sensor has a computer inside of it. That computer does math on all of the stuff that it's sensing, and then it sends that information to the spec ECU. So it is possible that the factories can kind of cheat a little bit inside that IMU. As such, like the electronics are definitely getting better. I have no doubt that HRC and Ducati and Yamaha have improved their IMU annually to work better with the spec ECU. All right, moving on. Number five. Mark Lapanzi wants... actually, I should have put this one towards the end. But all right, so not a tech question or a real question, but wondering, he's wondering what advice I can give to someone that is new to road racing but aspires to compete at the national level. So this is actually pretty close to my heart because I've only been racing nationals for technically 3 years. My first 2 years, I did one round my first year, 1.5 my second year because I crashed and broke my collarbone. And then my third year, I did 5 nationals. I'm planning on doing 4 this year. So you can say I'm kind of right on the fence. I'm in between. So 3 main points for improving your road racing for any level. Number one, get private coaching. You don't know what you don't know. So I guarantee that a lot of the skills that you think you have good, that you do well from street riding or from riding on the track as a novice, they're wrong. You're just doing stuff wrong. Like, you've heard about the tracks you can circle. That's straight up wrong. You hear about trail braking, and what you've heard is probably not that correct. There are so many things that you don't do well and you don't know how to fix them. Get private coaching. Number two, ride on new tires as often as you possibly can. New tires are the only way that you're going to go fast. Every single track session that you spend on old tires where you have to go 5 seconds slower than your personal records is wasted track time. Don't do that, right? If you're more than 2 or 3 seconds off your personal best and you're not stuck in traffic at a track day, you know, you're actually trying to go fast, that'll work. But if you 2 or 3 seconds off your personal best, that'll be fine. More than that, get new tires. My third point, go to as many tracks as you possibly can. There are a lot of corners at places that, and you can kind of learn to identify what you're good at. You can say you're good on corner entry on the brakes into one corner. You've got your knee on the ground while you're still braking. You take that, what you recognize in that corner, you apply it to a different corner. You apply it to tracks all around the country. Learn as many tracks as you possibly can. Don't get stuck at one place. The other thing too, when you go to a new track, you don't have your habits, like your slow habits. When I go to tracks that I've been to 1,000 times, it's often difficult for me to improve because I've done so many laps at that speed. I go to a brand new track and I race there right away. I pretty much go as fast as I possibly can because there are no bad habits to break. Those are my 3 points. Get on it. It'll cost you a lot of money, but it's totally worth it. All right. Question number 6. Alex Rode, what happens when MotoGP teams change the swing arm pivot or adjust the forks up and down? So these are general like geometry changes, suspension changes that World Superbike and MotoGP can make. Lesser classes, they probably can't change the swing arm height. They definitely can change the fork height. It's something that teams will do a lot. So swing arm pivot height is the only way that you can change the swing arm angle on a motorcycle without changing the ride height. If you don't have a swing arm pivot adjustment and you want to change the swing arm angle, if you want to increase the angle, you have to raise the ride height. But that might not be something that you want to do. Changing the swing arm angle has a drastic effect on what's called anti-squat. So like when you get on the gas really hard out of a corner, if you have a ton of anti-squat, the swing arm actually extends. Like it goes down. If you have no anti-squat, then the swing arm goes up, right? The suspension compresses. Having a good balance between anti-squat and swing and squat is how you get good drive out of a corner. Too much anti-squat and you spin the tire, not enough anti-squat and you can't finish the corner. Moving the fork, that changes a lot. It changes the rake, it changes the trail, changes the weight bias. The main thing, all of those pretty much just add up to how the bars feel when you're on track. Like a funny little hint, a lot of street riders will pull the forks really high up and think that, oh, the bars turn really easy now, so I can turn faster. No one racing does that. Essentially, bringing the forks up like that makes the bars turn easier. It doesn't actually make the bike lean faster. And you don't want the bars to turn easy when you've got your knee on the ground at 120 miles an hour through a corner. You want a lot of stability in the front end so that you can get into the corner. You can get into the corner on the brakes. My forks are really extended. The person that did them, like after we told him what specs to make them, he was like, you're making these as long as dirt bike forks. And I love them. I love my forks really long. I can control the fork height with the brakes. It's how I like to ride. All right, next question, number seven. Kevin Bowers, he wants to know about electronic suspension. So electronic suspension happened when Jerry Bridges was with Yamaha. He remember he talked about electronic suspension. They dabbled with it. However, it is now banned. It's been banned since, I think, 2008 or 2009. So his question is, do I think that electronic suspension will come back, and do I see it being an advantage? So I'm going to start this off. No, I don't think it'll ever come back. At least the current implementation isn't going to come back. Auto racing, the championship that shall not be named, figured out a long time ago that electronic suspension was like a huge rabbit hole that was super expensive. That championship had electronic suspension that actually could actually cause the ride height to change. We never actually had that in motorcycle racing, but it's crazy expensive. It's totally not worth it. The other thing too is really Öhlins is the only manufacturer that makes good electronic suspension, and good being relative, right? Because no one actually races on it. It's not legal in World Superbike. It is legal in World Superbike, but only in the stock form. Like, you can't modify it, so therefore no one uses it. It's not legal in GP, so Öhlins doesn't have a ton of time racing on it. All the club races that I know that had electronic suspension on their bike, they ditched it and they went faster. Electronic suspension sucks in its current implementation for racing. Because the factories aren't building it, they're not going to push for it in the rules. Do I see it being an advantage? If ideally, maybe. An ideal setup is all about minimizing compromises. Most of the time, when you're making compromises, say, you need one suspension setup for turn one, but you need a different suspension setup for turn four. Most of the time, those compromises are about geometry. So, like, I want 4 turns of preload for turn one. I want 8 turns of preload for turn four. Not often do you need, 3 clicks of rebound for turn one and 8 clicks of rebound for turn four. Usually, like, 5 clicks of rebound works in every corner. Because the current implementation of electronic suspension is mostly of changing damping, I really can't see it doing all that much and providing a huge advantage. Obviously, if GP was allowed to work on it and do whatever they wanted, they would probably introduce changing preload or changing ride height or something, and then we'd be right where Formula One was with the humongous ringer rabbit hole. Bikes are already turn by turn, so you technically could do that, but it's not a good idea. Question number eight. AJ Hendrickson, this is an interesting hypothetical. How far back in time would you have to take the worst bike on the grid today to make it the best bike on the grid? So we'll start with that one first. This one, I think about 3 to 4 years. You probably weren't expecting me to say that little, but you got to remember the oldest bike on the grid today, or at least for the 2018 season, is the GP16, the Ducati GP16. The GP16 won 2 races in 2016. Race times don't get that much faster every single year, maybe a couple of seconds. So it's very possible that if you wait, so if you took the GP, so you, t yeah, you take the GP16 back to 2015, and it could be the best bike on the grid. If we bring in KTM and Suzuki thing and Aprilia factories that haven't won races and have concessions, things are a little bit more hairy, but I wouldn't go more than 5 years. All right. The second part of the question is, if I got to ride the best bike on the grid, how far back would I have to take it to personally beat the top GP racers at the time? So this one is probably going to be further back than you think. I'm going with at least 20 or 25 years. So 10 years ago, qualifying times were about 2 to 3 seconds slower than they are today. 20 years ago, so back at 500cc when Rossi was racing, he was 5 to 6 seconds slower than he is today. Like, I looked up Mugello times, and they did a 56 for a pole last year, and they did 52s for pole in 2006 or sorry 96 or 97, and they even had qualifying tires back then, so things were even more different. My times, I'm probably at least 10 seconds behind Rossi on the same motorcycle. I'm 5 to 7% behind JD Beach in Moto America, which at a track that's 100 seconds long is 5 to 7 seconds. You got to imagine I'm double the small number there behind Rossi. 5 to 7 seconds behind JD Beach. Maybe 7 to 8 or 9 seconds behind Tony Elias in Moto America, 10 to 12 seconds behind Rossi. So I'm gonna go with 25 years minimum on that one. And we made it. The last question. James Doyle wants to know, why does Lorenzo ride faster using Map 8? So you remember last year at Sepang and Valencia, Lorenzo got Map 8 from his team on the electronics and on his pit board. Map 8, I would say Lorenzo rides faster because he's not really a team player, or he doesn't have that he's just not, what am I trying to say? He's just not going to do exactly what Ducati says. He thinks he knows a little bit better. And to be honest, he kind of did in certain situations. But you got to remember, there is no Map 8. The Spec Electronics, they have, how many maps do they have? They have about six, I'm pretty sure they have six maps. So you get three maps for fuel, you get three maps for traction control. Oh, and you technically get three maps for engine braking probably as well. So maybe you have nine maps. But Map 8 is, it doesn't describe anything. Those are all ABC anyway. So Map 8 was actually an instruction for Jorge to slow down and let Dovizioso by. At Sepang, he didn't need to do that. He made a mistake in the final corner, almost stuck the front, almost crashed, if I remember correctly. And Dovizioso got by. He didn't slow on purpose. At Valencia, there's good justification, a lot of argument that Jorge Lorenzo was actually faster than Dovizioso, and he was towing Dovi along, trying to get them to catch up. I believe that. I think it's true. So he didn't really need to get out of the way. All right, that's all the questions I got. That was nine at least, and with some two-parters in there. If you like this video, if you like this segment, like, share, and subscribe for sure, please. If you have any more tech questions, leave them in the comments below of this YouTube video. Please, someone think up a new segment title for me. Ask Rob Tech Questions just doesn't have a nice ring to it. Someone was telling me like Tech Time with Rob, but I'm not sure how I feel about that one. So definitely, please listen to Brodo GP. We'll like, share, and subscribe. We'll probably have another video out for you sometime early next week. Probably talking about the test, maybe some other stuff. I know you want more top five social media posts, so we'll do one of those soon. But all right, thanks for listening and take it easy.